Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Aya Ram, founder and CEO of CityBlock Health, a venture of Sidewalk Labs, a division of Google's parent company, Alphabet. They're creating a new system of tech-enabled care delivery that's addressing care gaps in underserved urban areas. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Aya Ram, CEO of CityBlock Health, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Aya Ram, founder and CEO of CityBlock Health, an innovative tech-enabled care delivery company focused on underserved patients in urban settings, a venture that was incubated with Alphabet's Sidewalk Labs. Prior to that, he was chief transformation officer at the Commonwealth Care Alliance, driving efforts to improve care delivery and health plan operations. He was founding policy director at the Health Policy Commission, and before that, he served in the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, working on the state's healthcare reform efforts. Mr. Ram served as an adjunct faculty at Atul Gawande's Ariadne Labs and was named to Modern Healthcare's list of up-and-comers. He earned his bachelor's in biology at Brandeis, studied medicine at Boston University. Aya, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me, Mark and Margaret. It's great to be with you this morning.
You've been a healthcare activist since you sought to enter the medical profession, and you founded CityBlock because you see health is the issue of our lifetime and that health disparities, the rise of chronic disease and unsustainable costs have increased poor health around the country. And you decided that health should be addressed at the granular level, which is in your name, right down to the block where someone lives. What is the tech-enabled approach you've deployed at CityBlock, and how does it address some of these upstream challenges?
I think it's important, Mark and Margaret, to first level set about what CityBlock is. We're about 18 months into the best journey of my life, certainly professionally, learning about approaches to community health transformation, technology spread, grassroots organizing, public health, and venture capital all alike, towards the question of how do you build a system that draws from all of these disciplines to improve health in communities all across the country. Fundamentally, we're a social justice company because we recognize that the profound failings of our health system, including many of those that you've just described, especially for those most vulnerable among us, are unacceptable. So we've sought at CityBlock to build a personalized health system that serves lower-income individuals living in steady neighborhoods that face barriers to good health for a whole host of reasons. We believe that health happens locally, and so we put each individual we care for, and importantly, their communities at the center of what we do. The care that we deliver is care that's designed for who our members are without judgment, delivered wherever they are. Our approach is rooted in the realization that personalized care can't be boiled down to one care model or to one tool set. I heard one of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Sachin Jain from CareMore, on your program recently, and he similarly described a philosophy and an approach that we also have built our company around. The idea that we have to build a wide array of tools within our proverbial toolbox. And the trick to doing this work well is figuring out in which order to pull out those and use those tools to understand quickly if they're not working, and then to find the right balance of trust, engagement, health outcomes, and cost efficacy to ensure that that algorithm to how you apply different approaches to each individual or community works most effectively. And this is important to who we are at CityBlock, is being comfortable recognizing that many of these tools, food, transportation, social connection, child and elder care, are largely unknown to the healthcare system. But if we accept that 40 to 60% of what impacts health outcomes is social, environmental, and nature, we have an imperative to build systems that address these factors. So what we do is build relationships with our members. We provide value-based and it is wholly capitated care to low-income urban populations, predominantly those on Medicaid, Medicare, and those who are dually eligible for both. We all know that this is a higher cost segment of the population, but we're also laser-focused on the fact that this group has disproportionately poor quality outcomes and poor experience of care, despite the fact that they have disproportionately high spending. We forge long-term relationships and bring services to meet them wherever they are, be it in our neighborhood hubs, at home, at work, in faith-based organizations or community centers. It all has to be local. So the three pillars of our model, just quick specifically, are community health partners, an entirely new workforce hired from the communities in which we serve, where we hire for empathy, for trust building, for relational skills. These are really the quarterbacks of our care team. They're guiding the rest of the care team. And then around them, we layer an integrated care team, RNs, care managers, social workers, behavioral health specialists, both primary care and psychiatric advanced practitioners and physicians, and a variety of other ancillary care staff, both employed and partnered to across the community, to build that integrated environment. Our neighborhood hubs serve as a primary care clinic. And in the future, we envision a variety of ways that each of these hubs is customized to its local community. For example, our first in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, has a child-friendly room where we can have a visit with one of our members at the same time as that member's children are playing with a variety of toys in that room. And then we have a digital platform that binds it all together. Community health partners and integrated care teams that deliver primary care, behavioral health, palliative care, alongside services that address the social determinants of health.
Well, I want to share with our listeners this very powerful infographic you have on your CityBlock website that sort of gets at this issue of how much things cost. And you use the example of if there were a hospitalization that cost $10,000. And you note the comparison to how many other services could have been provided for that same amount that would have potentially kept the person out of the hospital, and not just now in the short term, but on a longer term basis, 120 behavioral health visits or 500 hours with a community care worker. Share with our listeners how shifting some of the spending to the prevention model and to addressing the social determinants of health might just lead to better and less costly outcomes.
Sure. It is one of my favorite graphics out there. When you stop and think about it for a moment, an average hospitalization, which is going to shift a little bit market by market, accounts for those or hours of the community care worker, but also accounts for significant transportation, or one of my favorite statistics, 2.5 years of food stamps for a family of four. When you think about the opportunity for meaningful investment of those factors that underlie the health of a population, I think it's very clear that we have opportunity to reinvest. So we believe, and I think many models in this space have demonstrated, that you can reduce total acute utilization, emergency department spending, and inpatient hospital spending on the order of 35% to 40%. And so one thing that's worth noting about individuals who have significant health challenges, they are significantly more likely to be admitted from an emergency department into an inpatient setting. Even though with models like ours that can support them out in the community, that can provide wraparound services to help them be healthy, when you show up in the emergency department, hospitals are very good at getting you into their beds. On the specialty side, folks that move across the healthcare system that don't have the empowerment to advocate as effectively for themselves as others might, often have pretty significantly outweighed specialty spending. And on the pharmacy side, there are a variety of pragmatic factors here that I think are really important to consider. We had a member recently who had recurrent emergency department utilization, who made really smart choices to access the emergency department at the end of every month to get a 30-day refill of insulin, because they knew that the emergency department would ration that out to them at the end of every month. And the reason for that is because they had a $350 copay on that insulin medication. And so being able to find ways to intervene around the cost of pharmacy services, and also where it creates very meaningful barriers to care because of the lack of use of a generic, drives recurrent and preventable emergency department spending, I think, is really powerful. The reasons that people go to emergency departments are largely, again, fairly rational. You can look at a variety of major studies on this, that people are going for familiarity. It's a place in care where they are treated equally with all others, because the guiding principle that drives how people are prioritized in the emergency department is not insurance status, typically not race or ethnicity or gender. It is sick or not sick. That's virtually the only place in the healthcare system, outside of some of the exceptional community health centers among us, where people are not judged for the insurance card that they carry or for the way that they're dressed or where they live. One of my favorite recent anecdotes from a member who said that she goes for the Wi-Fi and the air conditioning in the emergency department. And so for all of those things, there are preventable ways for us to build trusting, safe spaces that are available after hours, a place to get a sandwich, a place to get Wi-Fi and air conditioning, and in so doing, make relatively incremental investments that drive very significant savings in the overall total cost of care.
So you've adopted this varied approach to improving access to state-of-the-art interventions. I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about how you're leveraging technology and what it looks like in your toolbox that you find effective.
Let me start by saying I never thought that I would be running a company that built technology. The journey for me of realizing that a common theme that both frustrated and stymied our care workers and the lack of meaningful tools to engage and communicate with those that we serve were ubiquitous everywhere that I went. So when I had an opportunity to partner with Sidewalk Labs to think about what CityBlock could become with a core infusion of technology from the outset, I got very excited by the possibilities. So the core of our technology asset, Commons, is a purpose-built platform for those consumers who tend to be overlooked. We know who they are, low-income Medicaid recipients, some of those on Medicare. And very specifically, it is seeking to pull together capabilities that I think are fundamentally fairly practical. Their capabilities around communication, how we think about task management, how we think about codifying workflow. And so we've created a framework in which our community health partners can assign tasks to the physician and can hold them accountable. We underwent a 9-month-long co-design process with a design insight group. And then very specifically, we hired onto our team a group of folks who think about product expertise that really fundamentally focus on beautiful user-friendly design. When I put in front of the senior Alphabet leadership screenshots from some of the leading electronic health records that are charging hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on the market today, they laughed and thought I was joking because they didn't realize that people actually built technology that looked like that. And so the opportunity to build simple, easy-to-use tools with the foremost goal of maximizing the value of human interactions, namely between our care team members, those that we care for. And some of this stuff just isn't that sexy, to be frank. Figuring out staff deployment models, it's figuring out workflow management. How do you move people across a community most effectively? How do you communicate across teams in seamless ways? And importantly, how do you capture all of it? For example, the ability to add family members or caregivers of our members that we are caring for directly into Commons as a full-fledged member of the care team. My mother-in-law passed at the end of last year, and I have to tell you, being able to have full visibility into what her care team was doing every day in those last months is such a powerful tool. And what we heard from our members was a real desire to be able to provide transparency to the father, mother, brother, sister, caregiver, whoever that was. The other thing that we've done is text messaging. One of the tools that we have built is a way to pull all of our text messaging content, which is a primary form of HIPAA-compliant communication between our members and their care teams, into a common database that directly feeds the record so that we can escalate clinically where somebody is expecting to be sick to a clinician member of the care team who's providing oversight. And then underneath it all, we've built integrated telehealth and a variety of really interesting clinical decision support tools, very specifically built around the social needs. The work on technology here is about asking very simple questions and building very simple solutions.
So when I think about what you're doing, the focus on value, in essence, you have what I would call, in some ways, a select population of universal insured people. But we think about the challenges that are out there right now. Pre-existing conditions could fall. Essential benefits could fall. The mandate has fallen, driving up premiums for everybody else. And the story that you told of the patient who had the $350 copay, they live by the millions in the United States. What are you thinking about? Are you looking at a strategy to make your model work to embrace those individuals as well? Talk with us a minute about that.
First and foremost, I think the orientation towards Medicaid is a very important design principle for us. Fundamentally, I believe that if you build a system that is oriented towards Medicare or those who are commercially insured, you are going to not force yourself from the outset to build systems that address factors that are fairly unique to the lowest income populations among us. And so it is easy to build to build and to not deeply engage in the comprehensive needs of social factors in populations that are not on Medicaid. That is not to, or dually eligible. That is not to suggest that there are not significant portions of other populations, as you say, that for a whole host of reasons on a state-by-state, region-by-region basis are struggling from the challenges of poverty. For us, that was an important lens from the outset, and also that fundamentally Medicaid has not been focused on by most companies that look like us. So what it forced us to do was build a toolkit, to my metaphor from the top, that was fully inclusive of all of the needs of those populations. And then importantly, also, I believe that it's sets up an opportunity for conversations about how you start to serve other populations in innovative ways. So I should note, for example, that our first partnership here in New York with Emblem Health stretches across virtually all of their lines of business. We're predominantly focused on those who are publicly insured on Medicaid, Medicare, or both. But also, when you're working, for example, in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which is where our first site is with that plan partner, there are a variety of folks who are living on the bubble of eligibility for those programs who are struggling with the same challenges of poverty. And in many ways, frankly, some of the social factors challenges around those populations are even more challenging to wrestle with in some instances. The individual that you referenced with the copay is a great example of this. That is not a challenge that a Medicaid beneficiary would face in the same way. Certainly, there are many others that are as profound, if not more profound, but it is a unique challenge to a certain type and kind of insurance. Another example of where this manifests is on some of the social factors. So, access to food supports may not be there in the same way for folks who are on individual markets, for example, but are struggling with challenges of poverty, and a variety of other examples abound from there. And importantly, part of our model is focused on trying to care for a whole household. And so, as you say, certainly on a given city block, there may be households living side by side that stretch across lines of business as we think about them in insurance parlance. Frankly, in a given household, there are also individuals that stretch across those buckets. And so from a care delivery perspective, we are built around the notion that we can care for whole family units and whole households. Medicaid is an important prerequisite, it's an important core component to this, and it's an important identity. But it, fundamentally, as you say, this is about caring for people and for populations. And thinking about it solely from a line of business perspective, we think.
We're speaking today with Aya Rahm, founder and CEO of CityBlock Health, an innovative tech-enabled care delivery company focused on underserved patients in urban settings, a venture of Alphabet's Sidewalk Labs. Aya, I think you may be in the vanguard of this trend of non-traditional companies leveraging their market power to create new pathways. That I think it was just in the last couple of months that Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and J.P. Morgan Chase also launched innovation. And I'm sure there are advantages and disadvantages of being engaged in an innovation venture like you are. But I wonder if you could pull the thread for us on how close you are to scaling this model. Are you planning to release playbooks so that we can see the evidence around this? And maybe also just paint this picture of what a national model of what you're contemplating might look like.
Sure. For us, we are pretty open and pretty humble about where we are stage-wise. We are an early company. We're a company that is humble to have gotten the attention that we've gotten because I think we're trying to tackle fundamentally a very hard set of problems and are trying to do so in a way that is both methodical and thoughtful about how we learn and iterate and improve, but also that is impatient because, as we've touched on a number of times in this conversation, there's tremendous and profound need across the country and real opportunity to scale these models. One of the things that motivated me in coming to do this work and specifically trying to do it through the lens of a partnership with Sidewalk Labs in the earliest instance was the fact that many of the models that we could all articulate on this conversation fundamentally have not scaled at the level that a large technology company would, for example, think of scale. If you add up all of the lives under management of companies that look like us and our variations on the theme in this space, it still numbers in the hundreds of thousands. And when we think about that compared with the profound opportunity, and by the way, I should say, these are amazing companies that I respect a lot, that are led by friends of mine who have created a space for us to be able to have conversations like this. And also this question of how you crack the nut of being able to do this on much larger scale, I think is very important. I think the movement that we see about across the country of understanding what space and place are for the delivery of healthcare services is really important. When we think about, for example, growth of models like this, I don't know yet, to be totally honest, what it looks like in terms of release of playbooks or care models or how you think about productizing some of that in technology as we think about large growth. Those are certainly things that we think about all the time. But what I do know is that the answer can't be building 3,000 clinics across the country. We all know healthcare has plenty of bricks and mortar as it is. What it has to be is finding ways for these models to scale across the chassis of existing infrastructure all across the country, and thinking about ways that we can build models that flex and hyperlocate, if you will, in a way that is heavily rigorous. And so we focus a lot of our time in thinking about implementation science. We spend a lot of our time in technology thinking about how do you build a system that, using advanced analytics capabilities and using the technology infrastructure that we have fundamentally rebuilt and how you manage a practice like this, how you learn your way very quickly to what the local evidence is of a model. We talk all the time, for example, about clinical guidelines, and take it with a grain of salt that this non-clinician ever uttering the words clinical guidelines is probably a mistake. But that notwithstanding, there's never been a randomized controlled trial of how you think about administering meds for somebody who has diabetes, who is also street homeless and couch surfs two weekends a month and, you know, eats out of the trash can. That is not how we think about clinical evidence. It's not how we think about care model evidence. And so part of our foundational bet is that by building insight-driven capabilities that allow us to learn very quickly, that allow us to understand how we even ask these questions of our members very quickly and tailor them to local context, which includes age, gender, sexual orientation, language preference, and a variety of other factors that are going to influence how people have conversations and build trusting relationships, that we can think about real opportunities to scale. And so I expect that we will try different variations of this over time. Our model in Brooklyn, I think, is a pretty interesting one as a first outset. This is something that I think is not widely known about us, but our practices in Brooklyn are actually co-located inside of an existing primary care practice group, Advantage Care Physicians of New York, which has been a very interesting partner for us because fundamentally, and this I think speaks again to the not building new bricks and mortar, fundamentally where patients have a meaningful trusted relationship with a provider, we have no interest in breaking that. And I think it's the wrong conversation to say, in order to get access to a new model of care, you marginalized, vulnerable person have to make a different choice about where you access care. Instead, we have to build systems that wrap these models and solutions around folks wherever they are and whatever choices they make. And so for a meaningful chunk of the population that we care for in New York, somebody, our members actually have a primary care provider that belongs to a different medical group. And we have a very close partnership with those medical groups to ensure that we are collaborating effectively and managing care together. I imagine that other models will emerge over time as well, as we think about ways to scale key aspects of this that are most effective.
We've been speaking today with Iyer Rahm, founder and CEO of CityBlock Health, an innovative tech-enabled care delivery company that's focused on underserved patients in urban settings. It's a venture of Alphabet Sidewalk Labs, and you can learn more about their work by going to cityblock.com or follow them on Twitter at CityBlock Health or at Iyer Rahm, that's IYAHROMM on Twitter. Iyer, thank you so much for your dedication to innovation in healthcare, to your focus on underserved populations, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for the conversation. I enjoyed it very much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Democratic senators have repeatedly claimed that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's history shows he would be a danger on the court to the Affordable Care Act. For instance, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said in late August that Kavanaugh, quote, has written opinions skeptical of our health care law. The Democrats point primarily to a case called Seven Sky v. Holder, which came before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, where Kavanaugh is a judge, in 2011. The appeals court rejected this challenge to the ACA's individual mandate, which requires most people to have insurance or pay a penalty. Kavanaugh dissented, but his objection concerned the jurisdiction of the court, not the constitutionality of the health care law. Kavanaugh wrote that the court shouldn't have heard the case because the Anti-Injunction Act said a tax must be assessed and collected before a suit against it could be decided, and the individual mandate didn't go into effect until the 2014 tax year. There are differing views on what his lengthy dissent may say about his stance on the ACA. The Federalist, a conservative publication, published opposing views on it. One commentator said Kavanaugh's dissent was a, quote, roadmap to save Obamacare, while another said that was, quote, nonsense. A law professor and expert on healthcare also wrote that Kavanaugh didn't show a strong opposition to the healthcare law in that case, or a second case that Democrats have also cited. That case, Sissel v. HHS in 2015, questioned whether the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional because it violated the Origination Clause of the Constitution, which says that legislation that raises revenue must originate in the House of Representatives. The appeals court rejected a request that the full court hear the case, saying, quote, the purpose of the ACA was to overhaul the national health care system, not to raise revenue. Kavanaugh dissented, saying the ACA was indeed a revenue-raising bill, but he said it complied with the origination clause. He said he would grant a rehearing of the case, but he went on to argue that the court should rule for the government. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tens of millions of people around the world have conditions that make it impossible for them to speak on their own, requiring them to adopt a computerized voice box for communicating. Perhaps the most well-known of these folks is the physicist Stephen Hawking.
I would have thought it was fairly obvious what I meant.
The problem is, that sound of Hawking speaking through his voice box is the same voice sound, say, that a 10-year-old girl with a neurologic disorder might be forced to use as well, because there just haven't been many voice options on the market.
In the U.S. alone, there are 2.5 million Americans who are unable to speak, and many of whom use computerized devices to communicate.
At a recent TED Talk, speech researcher and innovator Dr. Rupal Patel shared a program she has launched that can change that reality, Vocal ID.
I thought there had to be a way to reverse engineer a voice from whatever little was left over. So we decided to do exactly that. We set out to create custom-crafted voices that captured their unique vocal identities.
Creating a voice bank of donor voices that will allow voices to be individualized for each unique patient seeking to communicate through an electronic voice box.
Why don't we take the source from the person we want the voice to sound like and borrow the filter from someone about the same age and size, because they can articulate speech, and then mix them. Because when we mix them, we can get a voice that's as clear as our surrogate talker and is as similar in identity to our target talker. It's that simple.
Since this popular TED Talk in February, 16,000 people have signed up to be voice donors at the Human Voice Bank Initiative. So volunteers, like this little girl, will read a series of simple phrases over a several-hour period.
Things happen in pairs. I love to sleep. The sky is blue without clouds.
And then those phrases are matched with the voice footprint of the patient being provided for.
This voice is only for me. I can't wait to use my new voice with my friends.
Such speech synthesis will give that person the dignity of a speaking voice that is as closely matched to their own identity as possible. To take that dream from the lab into the real world, Dr. Patel, who's a professor of computer engineering at Northeastern University, has launched the website vocalid.com.
I imagine a whole world of surrogate donors from all walks of life, different sizes, different ages, coming together to give people voices that are as colorful as their personalities.
And with the bank of voice donors now building around the world, Dr. Patel expects that patients with conditions ranging from muscular dystrophy to Lou Gehrig's disease or stroke will, one day, be given the chance to communicate in a voice made just for them. The Human Voice Bank Initiative, matching vocal donors with millions of people who seek to authentically communicate with friends and family in a voice that most closely matches what would be their own. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.